Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Mark Dunlight.
And I'm Dan Pfeiffer. Today, we are discussing with Blair Horner of NYPIRG how the corruption trial of one of Governor Cuomo's top aides will impact on ethics reforms at the state capitol. Then, as part of our regular Wednesday Peace segment, we discuss Korea with David Easter. And later on, I'll be talking with activist and writer Brendan C. Byrne.
And we end up with WOOC correspondent Steve Pierce speaking with members of the One Troy Anti-Poverty Program about their efforts to address pervasive issues of income inequality with a focus on North Troy.
But first, the headlines.
Few weeks of the corruption trial of the former top aide to the governor, Mr. Prococo. Blair, what are some of the key issues at trial here?
Well, Prococo is the first of seven trials that will happen, high-profile corruption cases that will go to trial over the next few months through the summer. A second trial, just FYI, is former State Senator Maziar's pled guilty to misuse of campaign funds, and he avoided jail time, but he has to pay a fine. So that was trial two. Trial one has gone to the jury, and it's the case of a former top aide to the governor, Joseph Prococo, who is alleged by the U.S. attorneys to have accepted bribes in the neighborhood of $300,000. As part of the deal, he would accept these bribes, and he would use his influence to get state entities to do what these what individual organizations wanted. So these businesses that had business before the government, a company in Syracuse and a company in the Mid-Hudson Valley, allegedly, according to the U.S. prosecutors, used bribes to get the former top aide to the governor to intervene on their behalf in regulatory matters. And that's really at the heart of the trial.
Now, we're talking about this as there's still the jury is out, so before we know what the verdict is. But regardless of the verdict, what is sort of the, you know, broader message that both the public and I think those at the Capitol need to take away from this trial?
Well, in a sense, you're right. I mean, the jury is now considering whether or not Prococo violated federal bribery statutes. And so the verdict is out on him. We don't know yet. But the verdict is in on Albany, which is that the state's system of monitoring the way it doles out government contracts and economic development is very flawed, significantly flawed. And it has allowed a situation to exist where you're raising the risk of corruption. So, for example, in addition to the alleged bribes that occurred, some of the other things that came up as evidence and testimony in the trial deals with things like how a lobbyist was able to quarterback campaign contributions from a developer in Syracuse to the tune of $125,000 and use limited liability companies, a network of limited liability companies, to get the money into the governor's reelection effort as a way to circumvent the public knowing who it's from. Another issue that came up in the trial was the fact that one lobbyist was able to communicate with many high-ranking members of the administration through their personal email accounts, and that in those emails they were discussing how to do the public's business, and that's a no-no as well. So there are other issues that came out of the trial. Another was that the Prococo, when he left government to work as the campaign manager, thus he's a private citizen, was able to keep his security card, which is unheard of, to have easy access into the governor's office. It is alleged by the U.S. attorneys that he used his government office to run the campaign and to make communications from his old office in terms of phone calls, et cetera. People saw him going in and out, and yet nobody did anything about it. How did that happen? So there are a number of issues that come out that are not necessarily relevant to whether or not federal bribes were bribes that violate federal law were involved, but do trigger questions about state policy. So it's pretty clear that there are pay-to-play measures that have to be taken. It's pretty clear that there needs to be better oversight of the contracting process by an independent entity. It's pretty clear that the state's ethics laws need to be overhauled and that the state needs a new watchdog that's independent of political pressure.
Now, over the last several decades, several dozen state legislators have in fact been convicted of various forms of corruption and bribes and other misbehavior. The governor himself seemed to have initially came in on a pledge to reform Albany. And yet, if anything, the situation seems to be getting worse. The governor's amassed what, a $30 million or so war chest, taking huge donations from particularly real estate and other people seeking favors. Is this trial and the next six or seven trials going to be enough to finally shake, you know, Albany and demand real reform?
Well, I work for NYPERG, right? So I'm a hopeless optimist. I have to admit, I would have thought that the indictment and convictions of the former Speaker of the Assembly and the former Senate Majority Leader would have tipped the balance. The trial with Prococo may not be enough. We don't know. But it'll be a steady drumbeat of trials from now until the summer. And another major trial to play out still is going to be the trial around Buffalo Billion, the so-called Buffalo Billion, where the U.S. Attorney's Office, again, alleges a pay-to-play scheme that hot-wired contracts to benefit big contributors to the governor. So we'll see. These cases still have to play out. You never know. Everyone's innocent until proven guilty. But the issue is not going to go away. And so whether or not the governor chooses to use this opportunity that's been handed to him to advance meaningful reforms, I think we will see. But we're certainly hopeful that that's what will happen.
Now, you know, we also face this situation. The governor's up for re-election. He may face a primary. But at this point, you know, the Republican, John DeFrancisco, one of the top Republicans, is running. You know, what are the chances that, you know, the various parties will actually say this is the time to finally do something? Does the election year make it more likely that something's going to happen, or let's get out of Albany and not create too much damage?
Well, it depends on how cynical the electeds view this sort of situation. I mean, at a certain level, you would think when they're all up for re-election and the public is unhappy with what they see at the state capitol, and every poll tells you that that's the case, that they would feel compelled to do something about it. I mean, that's their job, right? To get elected to come to Albany to fix problems. Ethics and corruption is a big problem. But they may just choose to think that the voters, while unhappy about what they see in Albany, won't vote based on that unhappiness and decide to just ride out the storm, that in fact it's worse to try to create the kinds of things that we want that will make a more open, transparent, accountable system that reduces the risk of corruption, and they'll just choose to leave it that way. So again, I'm hopeful that it being a re-election year, a re-election for the governor, this is clearly a promise that he made, you're right, two terms ago, now two elections ago, that he was going to come to Albany and clean it up, and I think it's fair to say that that is a promise yet to be fulfilled, and this is the session for him to do it.
Now, you mentioned the term, you know, pay-to-play, which usually refers to the fact that, you know, individuals who are getting contracts and other positions of influence with the government in exchange make campaign contributions to legislators or governors that help them, you know, secure those positions. Is there a risk that if, in fact, the jury decides, well, this may be unethical, but it's not illegal under the existing language of various federal and state statutes, that, in fact, it becomes even more of an open season on this pay-to-play games that take place at the Capitol?
Well, sure, there's a possibility that people will decide that because the federal statute is useless, therefore the U.S. prosecutors won't come to Albany to try to do anything, that they'll just think that they can get away with what they think they can get away with. And certainly the state system, the state laws, the state oversight is weak, fatally flawed. And if that's never going to get fixed, then maybe people feel like they can do that. Now, that being said, I don't think that Prococo in particular would want this wished on anyone. If he's ultimately exonerated by the jury, he will have spent a lot of time having his image, his reputation besmirched. The governor will have had to have endured it. There will be a lot of legal fees that still have to be paid. By the way, we're not quite clear who's paying for the legal coverage now for Prococo. But all that being said, if there's no conviction, that means he's not in it. He's not guilty, and he shouldn't deserve to go to prison for things that he didn't commit. But the system is still flawed. There's no getting around that, and that does have to be fixed. And that's what the governor and the legislature are here to do. And if they don't do it, big problem.
Okay, in the last 30 seconds, can you list what are the two or three biggest fixes needed?
Well, I mean, if you want to deal with campaign finance, you got to deal with the limited liability company loophole, which allows one company through its many limited liability companies to funnel in as much money as they want into the system. It's a huge gaping hole in the campaign finance system. Limiting campaign contributions from those seeking government contracts, a public system of public financing, a real independent ethics oversight agency, and empowering the comptroller to aggressively monitor state contracts. Under the current governor, the power of the comptroller has been cut back. He's an independently elected official, and his job should be to monitor these contracts. Those things would be some ways to get started.
Thank you, Blair Horner, New York Public Interest Research Group Executive Director.
That was WOOC correspondent Mark Dunley discussing the impact of the trial of the governor's former top aide on corruption charges. If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM. Have an event you want us to promote? Send us a text message at 518-888-3004.
Each Wednesday, we cover the peace community in the Capital District. David Easter is a longtime activist in the Capital District who has followed events in Korea closely. In fact, I think I first met David back in 1980 when he was running the Committee for a New Korean Policy. But he's also a member of the Upper Hudson Peace Action Steering Committee. So welcome, David, to WOOC. And maybe you could start off by giving us just a little bit of your own background of involvement with Korea and then, you know, bring us up to speed on the current state of relations.
Yes, Mark. Thanks for having me on the your program. I did work for the Committee for a New Korea Policy for 15 years. This was a group that was working to change U.S. foreign policy towards Korea. We were working for and to support or the South Korean dictatorships, which that has changed by now. We were working to get nuclear weapons out of Korea. The U.S. used to station tactical nuclear weapons there. Those weapons are out, but we still have the nuclear issue before us. And we were working for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Korea, and those troops are still there. So this has been a long time effort over that time. I haven't been in the forefront of organizing on this for the last period, but I am have followed Korea with great interest all through the years.
Most Americans don't remember the history of the Korean War and how it impacts upon the current situation today. Could you give us an overview?
Well, Korea was one country, the country of Korea, for 5,000 years. It, at different times, had to pay tribute to China, or it had, but it was a single country from 1910 until the end of the Second World War. It was a colony of Japan. And Japan still is disliked by Koreans for the treatment that they received during that period. At the end of the Second World War, Korea was divided arbitrarily by the United States and Russia, who each sent troops into United States into the southern half of the country, Russia into the northern half, and Korea has been divided ever since. Into two different countries. The Russians pulled their troops out, but the U.S. kept their bases and troops in South Korea. North Korea has continues to have, both countries had dictatorial forms of government, but North Korea continues to have a top-down dictatorial society. The South Korea has a democratic government now. So this was like and then in 1950 there was a essentially both sides, there was a desire for the Korea to get back together as one country. There were groups organizing all across North and South to try to get Korea reunified. There was basically what we had was this, turned into a civil war situation. North Korea says South Korea started it. South Korea and the U.S. said North Korea started it, and that's the history that we hear. And but it was a bloody, awful civil war for 3 years. In the end, and many U.S. soldiers went into Korea, and then China sent troops in. And in 1953, the war ended in a stalemate, and an armistice agreement was agreed to that left the country divided into two parts. And really was no peace settlement or resolution to the end of the war. In theory, the U.S. is still at war, suspended. through this armistice with North Korea. And the fact is we've had a hostile relationship towards North Korea for all of these decades since. The U.S. has had a very consistent policy, which is to place economic sanctions on North Korea and to keep our troops in, viewed North Korea as a military threat, and to treat it as an enemy, have annual many both spring and summer war games with large numbers of troops in South Korea to prepare for a war with North Korea. North Korea consequently views the U.S. as an enemy, and has. Reason to remember, you know, like their capital, at the end of the Korean War, there was only one building left standing.
So, actually, we're going to get a little bit more depth about this. But,
we want to talk about the very hopeful situation right now. We want to get into that pretty soon.
Okay. So what do the people in Korea, and I'm talking about both sides, North and South, what do they want at this point, as opposed to what the various political and military leaders want?
There's a lot of years have passed. There's still a very strong longing in Korea for the country to be reunified, in theory at least. And there, all of their tens of there are tens of thousands of families that are still divided who have no contact with their relatives on the other side of the border. The people who will still remember people in their family are quite elderly right now. But it's this is a ongoing concern for Koreans. Of course, neither side wants to live under the system of the other. So the Korean people basically don't want another war. They realize how disastrous that would be. So that's the starting point, even though each side has a large military and, you know, prepares for war. But ordinary people have a strong, you know, can't imagine what would happen if there was a war.
You were starting to say that there's reason to be optimistic. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, you know, we've lived over the last months, this last year under the feeling of threat from North Korea by the people in the U.S. have been concerned about North Korea's nuclear weapons. During most of this history, North Korea provided absolutely no threat to the United States itself. They're a small country. They're an impoverished country. They're a distant country. They have a coastal navy, but they don't have a navy that could attack us, or planes that could attack us, or any. They're not a military threat. They are a military threat to South Korea, because half the population of South Korea lives in close proximity to North Korea. Seoul, the capital, is 35 miles from the demilitarized zone, the dividing line between North and South Korea. So if a war started, the population of this Seoul metropolitan area is huge. It's 25 million people in the whole metropolitan area, and they are all within, say, artillery range of and missile range of by North from North Korea. So if a war started, the estimates by our own military are that within the first week or two, maybe 300,000 people would be dead. So it would just be miserable. Now, of course, North Korea is under similar threat from the South. The South has outspent the North at least 2-1 every year for the last 40 years. They have a much more sophisticated, technologically sophisticated military. The South Korea has twice the population of North Korea. They have a much larger GMP or economy than North Korea has. So North, just militarily, we have this situation of threat. But in the last, starting with the Olympics, the current government in South Korea is a progressive government and has been pushing for dialogue with North Korea. And they used the Olympics to invite North Korea to send high-level delegations and to send a team to, teams to compete in the Olympics, which happened. And at that, during the Olympics, the president of North Korea, Kim Jong-un, sent his sister as a representative, and she carried a message from her brother to the South Korean president saying that they would like to have direct dialogue. There has been, on two other occasions, North and South Korea have had summits between the presidents of the country, and there have been steps towards reconciliation and easing of tensions. But then, at least in the South Korean case, a new election, last time this happened, a conservative government came in, and they just put a halt to a lot of the dialogue. So then this week, the South Korea sent a high-level delegation to North Korea and met with the North Korean leader, who said that agreed to have another summit meeting between North and South Korea, the presidents, which will take place near the end of April.
David, we're about out of time, so I'm going to give you about a minute and a half. So what constructive role can the United States play at this point?
If people
want more information about the Korean situation, how best to find it?
Yeah. U.S., how the U.S. responds to this dialogue is crucial. President Trump's initial response has been positive in terms of the sense we could have dialogue. North Korea has said that they would eliminate their nuclear weapons if they would have security guarantees. Now, that's the rub. What exactly does that mean? They clearly would want a peace treaty and a non-aggression pact and a reduction of the war games that are aimed at them, and either elimination getting the U.S. troops out of Korea or a reduction of U.S. troops in Korea. But we don't know. We have to talk to them to find out what will happen. So it's going to be very important that that these negotiations be supported and followed.
Well, David, thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. Okay. Thank you so much. Goodbye.
And that was David Easter's part of our Wednesday Peak segment. And for those of you just tuning in, I'm Mark Dunlop.
And I'm Dan Pfeiffer. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org.
Next, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Your segment.
Oh, we're skipping to my segment. Okay.
So we have a segment
we're doing
that
it
Dan
live.
Did. Dan,
yes.
What was your segment about?
Sorry. I'm looking at the live script that was just edited out from under me. Here we go. For my ongoing series on data justice, today I spoke to author and activist Brendan C. Byrne about Palantir, data mining, and the seasteading movement. Wait, let me set you up here. I'm a tech worker, and I have a lot of reservations about how the tech industry relates to society at large. Especially in San Francisco, there's been a lot of movement activism organizing against these private buses that take workers from San Francisco down to Silicon Valley. I'm a member of a group that was organizing against Palantir, and Brendan was the kind of ringleader of this group. And we're going public for the first time here talking about it on WOOC. Brendan, tell us about this effort to bring light to what Palantir has been up to.
Okay. Well, I mean, I'm not sure if I was entitled to a ringleader. There was a bunch of us who were all doing the organizing. One of the things that we were trying to do was focus on how regular engineers, I mean regular, but like, you know, everyday people who go to work and work for these huge data harvesting or data analyzing companies, even if what the specific things they're working on, even the specific cases they're working on, aren't, you know, involved in the mass deportation agenda, even if they're not, you know, actively enabling serious, harmful, problems, they're still bolstering the company and they're still doing work for the company. And what we're trying to do is confront them just sort of in person, not necessarily aggressively, but just we were flyering right outside, Dan and I were, as well as a bunch of other people, the New York City offices, which is sort of tucked away on this really opulent little side street in, the Meatpacking District in New York City.
If I can just cut in, some listeners may not be familiar with what Palantir does. What is their business exactly?
Well, they try to sort of associate it with like a lot of mystical BS. But basically, what they do is they aggregate a lot of data and they try to like draw points between it, and which sounds kind of like not a big deal. And actually, sort of one of the things that I guess sparked this conversation, this interview, is the big article on Palantir New Orleans, which was that ProPublica or who published that?
I think that was in The Verge. This is
That's right. That was The Verge.
Ali Winston published this on the 27th.
Right. And I was talking to one of our friends, and I saw that. And one of the things he said was, he's like, none of the stuff in there is like really that hard to do. they're not being ultra specific about the stuff they're doing. They're just taking the names of people who get in traffic stops, or like this person is like cousins with this person who's in jail for selling drugs. And then they're creating sort of a map and then sort of mapping all this data they have against where people live, where they work, you know, what schools they go to, what schools their kids go to, and then sort of drawing this map and then taking that information and then trying to figure out, well, where do we think the next gang shooting is going to happen? What this leads to is this sort of weird idea, and I think James Carville and Mary Madeline, I'm not sure if I'm saying her name right, they're sort of like the prime power couple from like the early 90s, like Republican Democrat. They were both like, he's a Democrat, she's a Republican, and they're both big in New Orleans, and they helped bring Palantir into the New Orleans situation. And one of the things that she said was, she was like, you know, you don't really have to worry about this unless, you know, your cousin was a drug dealer. And this is like the most ridiculous thing in the world. Like, okay, everyone's fine unless they happen to be related to someone who's done something wrong. I'm definitely related to people who've done something wrong. And I think, you know, a lot of people out there are. So that's sort of what Palantir does. And they do this for, sort of famously for international policing or military use. You know, they worked at the CIA. They're famously sort of stum on whether or not they helped provide information that enabled the U.S. Special Forces to kill Osama bin Laden. And they sort of do this, like, nudge-wink thing. We're like, yeah, we killed bin Laden. But now they're sort of trying to do more and more domestic stuff. And that is, I guess, New Orleans is a big part of that. And I've heard vague rumors about Detroit, but that's really vague, and I don't want to, like, say that that's real.
One of the controversies with Palantir has also been their coordination with the government finding undocumented immigrants and assisting with the deportation regime.
Yeah. So that's interesting. There's a lot of stuff going on there. Palantir was building a series of sort of systems that were helping DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, to, I believe, specifically track gang violence like MS-13 or stuff like that. And one of the things that we were very unsure about, we were trying to get more information on this, is that whether or not, like, ICE, the people who are doing, you know, the sub-agency that's doing, you know, rounding up people and, like, you know, doing traffic stops and stuff like this and, you know, actively deporting people, was able to get access to that those systems. And, you know, sort of Palantir employees who we talked to claimed that they weren't. And their reasoning for this was pretty technical in the sense that they were like, well, the people from, you know, the DHS think the people at ICE are sort of like morons and don't want to share, like, the system with them. Which, you know, sounds a little bit, like, right if you think about sort of like how federal bureaucracies are sort of infamously bad at coordinating with each other. But at the same time, it's like, I mean, one of the purposes of the Department of Homeland Security was to make inter-organizational federal bureaucracies easier to manage. And so we basically just have, like, a bunch of people who work at Palantir's, like, word or supposition, not even their word, that ICE won't be using their tech to, you know, to help deport people. And so, yeah, that's kind of a problem.
It seems like there's a lot of secrecy around to what degree their technology is effective or even when it's being used in a criminal case. In that Verge article about New Orleans, there was a case that was brought as the result of this sort of data mining. And during the discovery in the case, they didn't disclose that this was a part of how the defendant was chosen. And it seems like nobody in New Orleans city government knew that it was happening. It was sort of like this secret process that was happening. So why all this secrecy? I suspect it's that, to some degree, it's snake oil, and it's just an excuse to, like, harass people with this magical data mining stuff going on.
Well, that is sort of one of the big questions about all these sort of Silicon Valley or Silicon Valley-derived, like, cyber-libertarian, you know, ideas. And, you know, this sort of extends across, you know, cryptocurrency like Bitcoin or these sort of weird, like, Ponzi scheme situations like seasteading. Exactly how much of it is, like, snake oil, how much of it is sort of Silicon Valley continuing the great American tradition of hucksterdom, and how much of it is, like, seriously, you know, real damaging, you know, like, systems. How much, you know, if it works properly, it's going to be really bad, or how much, but is it working properly in the first place? And if it's not, how much of the sort of the hucksters bought their own shtick? And it's a weird situation, and I'm not inside any of these organizations or systems, so I don't know. But either way, it's kind of worrying because it definitely sort of like the ideology leaks into the mainstream. And a big thing Palantir does is Palantir is named after one of the seeing stones in Tolkien's Lord of the Rings trilogy, and it's sort of like Peter Thiel loves Tolkien, like, imagery, and one of the big things is, you know, it's sort of like the eternal battle of light against darkness, and, you know, he sees himself on the side of the light, and Palantir is sort of like this, you know, like, force of good, And, you know, sort of that sort of like reductive black and white imagery has obviously been used as a means of, you know, imperialism and colonialism and racism throughout, you know, the last, what, 500, 600, 700, 800 years, whatever. And so it's now it's sort of being repurposed by this sort of like magical, like tech, BS, basically.
You mentioned seasteading earlier, and I wanted to draw attention to this article that you wrote in Rhizome about this this group of seasteaders who were documented by this filmmaker under the art group Dis magazine, I believe. And maybe you can describe the scenario. It's kind of this weird situation.
What's interesting about this is just something that the filmmakers and just turned Rhizome and a number of their outlets onto, which is that these two filmmakers had gone, I don't think they were invited, I think they sort of asked permission and were allowed to go on to this this sort of like fact-finding mission where these members of the Seasteading Institute were going to meet members of the French Polynesian community and government, which is where the Seasteading Institute wants to start a seastead, a functional sort of like offshore libertarian utopia, which will be outside of all laws, but most importantly outside of tax laws. So, you know, you sort of have all these sort of stereotypical, you know, middle-aged white dudes who are like hanging out at what looks to be like a, you know, sort of a tropical island paradise, or at least, you know, sort of like the commercialized version of that. And sort of behaving in this sort of like sort of vaguely creepy way, and obviously the film they shot didn't make the Institute look that good, but what the Institute had made them do, the filmmakers, was sign a contract stating the Institute would have access to all the footage and could recombine it and reuse it in whatever form they wanted to, and the filmmakers, I think, thought that this was just going to be like, oh, we'll just use it for commercial purposes, or it, like, you know, if they want to put together like a little like pamphlet, video pamphlet, or whatever. And but what they did instead was they released their own documentary on YouTube with the exact same search engine optimization, the exact same name, with a trailer that was almost exactly the same. So it was kind of like they were just trying to like push out the critical documentary and release their own and sort of replace it, which obviously has, you know, sort of worrying symmetries to the way that, fake news is thought about or sort of pushed out there by these extreme right-wing organizations and people. We're going to replace reality with our own version of reality.
It sounds like a more extreme version of one of those films that gets recut a million times. You know, there's like the Blade Runner final cut, but there's also like the director's cut, and there's five other cuts probably. Technically, I guess if it was in IMDb, it would be a single title with like two versions that happen to not look anything like the other one.
Yeah, I don't know. It's interesting. I talked to one of the filmmakers about this, or I emailed with him about this, and what he said was he was actually kind of excited about the fact that someone had repurposed his footage to make a statement that was totally opposite to the one he was trying to make, just from an artistic, like, he was angry about it, but from an artistic point of view, he thought it was pretty cool.
Well, that's all the time we have, Brendan, but thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Dan.
That was Brendan C. Byrne talking about Palantir, tech activism, and seasteading as part of my ongoing series on data justice.
In our next segment, WOOC correspondent Steve Pierce speaks with members of the One Troy Anti-Poverty Program about their efforts to address pervasive issues of income inequality with a focus on North Troy.
Okay, we're here with Dylan Hall, Deborah Garrett, and Sadeja Wheeler, part of One Troy, a new CEO project designed to help neighborhoods in Troy with poverty and other pressing social problems. Dylan, tell us a bit about One Troy. How did it come about? What is the program?
So One Troy is a collaborative effort of nonprofits, residents, businesses, schools and stuff focusing on poverty reduction. It started through Governor Cuomo with a what's called the Empire State Poverty Reduction Initiative. He had given 16 cities some monies to try to tackle poverty. In Troy, we have tremendous issues with perpetual and pervasive poverty. Just even in our neighborhoods where we're located right now, there's up to 50, 60, 70% poverty rates. If you're a child under the age of 18, it's a 50%. And the numbers have doubled over the last 8 to 10 years in terms of rates. And so One Troy is a collaborative effort to try to bring groups together and try to really strengthen what exists already. I like to say it this way. One Troy does three things. We bring people together. Very simply, we convene them. We build capacity of others. In other words, we strengthen them. And then we help foster collaborative action. So with those three things, we're an intermediary. I always say that we are not a new program. We're just a platform. And we're bringing those different initiatives together. There's no shortage of people doing great work. The problem is that it's often program rich and coordination poor. And so to tackle something as challenging as poverty, we need to figure out how to do that together because no one of our organizations can do that alone.
So you have a team that you're working with.
Yeah. So not only have we formed over the last year a steering committee with, again, a number of nonprofits, residences, businesses, the city themselves, but we've also started to build our own capacity and bring in some team members for One Troy. And so with me is Deborah and Sadeja. So I'm going to ask Deborah just to share a little bit about her hat as a resident in the areas that we're focusing on, which is North Central and Hillside, north of Troy, but also as her role on the staff here with One Troy.
So I initially started working with One Troy in July, and I was a little excited just to see the things that was trying to become of One Troy in my area that I live in. I'm excited because I don't plan on leaving this area for a while. And working with One Troy, it lets me see the insides of the things that just the city of Troy is actually in need of. I know the committee that I'm on for the, the work group, excuse me, that I'm on, we're focusing on safety, and you'd be surprised how much the person's perspective is related to safety versus what we assume, which we thought was going to be a high crime rate, but it wasn't that. It was just the basic things like sidewalks and street lights and things like that. So as a resident, I'm happy to see that One Troy is going to tackle some of those issues just to make my area feel a little bit more safe for me and my children and my neighbors. And I'm just excited to be a part of One Troy, just the growth and the different context that I'm gaining, and just the strength of One Troy is awesome.
And so also in addition to Deborah, we have Sadeja, who's an AmeriCorps Vista who just started. So I'll let her share just a few moments about her involvement and what she hopes to see over this next year.
So my involvement with the One Troy Project is just going to be, amazing. I'm just excited to see the change that is going to come. Being a resident, well, a new resident of Troy, New York, you see the difference between coming to visit and actually living here and the growth that has started to become, but just seeing the overall outcome of how how everything is laid out to come. It's just, you see the difference from how some neighborhoods looked years ago to how they look now. And I'm just excited to see the overall outcome of the growth of what's going to happen.
So one of the biggest things for One Troy is building, not only aligning kind of initiatives and programs, but what we're seeing even in our meetings is fascinating, where we have people around the table who have not typically met before or have been in some contentious meetings or, you know, the town hall style where people are just throwing insults or they're throwing ideas at the wall, which is great, but not really becoming productive. And so what we've seen over and over again in our meetings is that people are sitting across from each other going, oh, you're doing this type of work? Wow, we are trying to do this type of work too. And they're going away from these meetings with just a little bit more awareness. And at least on their radar and on their map, what can we do together? Because As one of our values for One Troy says, none of us are as good as all of us. It's actually going to continue to take all of us. So what's next? We hope to release an RFP with a kind of pool of money that our work groups around five focus areas can tap into. Those five focus areas are youth, safety, revitalization, housing, and jobs. And so people and nonprofits will submit requests for tapping into some of that money, again, to strengthen programs, to collaborate, and then to put those plans into action. We hope to have some quick wins first and then some long-term plans as well. Beyond the focus of North Central and Hillside North, then we will hope to scale it to other areas of the city as we grow.
So we're speaking with Dylan Hall, Deborah Garrett, and Sadasia Wheeler, all from CEO and the program One Troy. I guess I'd be the devil's advocate here. I know that in the 1960s when I was a kid, the war on poverty was a flat-out assault on many of the same problems you're describing today. And yet, as you say, the problem is getting worse. It seems like we have structural problems. There are problems with capitalism itself that creates these situations. And the forces seem bigger than the power of anybody at a community level to do anything about it. What can we really do if the system itself is at fault?
Absolutely. So with our initiative, looking at it, the systemic challenges for the first year we've realized are beyond our capabilities. So can we build from the ground up and focus on a population level, what we call population level accountability? In other words, can we wrap this plan around a small geographic region neighborhood wide and see if we can have some success with, you know, so if, say if the neighborhoods we are focused in have 1,000 people, can we just get 10% of people from poverty to sustainability with a multiple services wrapping around them? Now, at the same time, we're working with like the city of Albany. They're putting together a pretty thorough white paper on the cliff effect, which is one of the many, many systemic issues inhibit people from getting out of poverty to sustainability. So the cliff effect, if you're not familiar with it, is there's this line in the sand that says if you make just $5 more than this amount of money, you lose vital services as a family. Could be childcare or other public assistance. And so there's a lot of policies in place. And so absolutely, the issue is huge. And so we're going to just start where we're at, do for one what we'd like to do for all, and then try to grow it from there.
Well, obviously the problems are too vast to cover in the short amount of time here. I guess one question I'd have, if we can cover it in a minute or so, which is laughable, but do you feel are the short and long-term goals that you have for this project?
Yeah, so for short-term, things that we're trying to measure, and that's a great question, is just that social connections. Again, it's just like awareness that I was mentioning earlier of groups coming together, I found four or five strategic plans, for example, just in these neighborhoods of North Central and Hillside North that existed simultaneously that didn't know about each other's plans. And so just having those conversations, I look at the city and just the neighborhoods like this big net where we can, and the net is all untied. And so can we go and tie this little piece of the net and this little piece of the net? Long-term, obviously, we want to see a reduction in poverty. Can we at least reverse the trend where it's, again, gone double digits? In Troy, we are twice as high poverty rate as Rensselaer County. And Troy, depending on what stat you're looking at, comparison to Schenectady and Albany also has some of the highest numbers. So can we, over long time, 10-year is kind of our overarching vision, can we see a reduction or, you know, a reversal of that trend?
Well, this is a great discussion to have, and this is a great place to do it. If folks want to get more involved, if they want to find out more about what you're doing, where can they go?
Absolutely. So the best place is to go to onetroy.org, and you can read about the initiative, and you can connect with us, email us, and follow our social.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Dylan, Deborah, and Sadasia. I'm sorry we didn't have enough time to really get into it, but we'll have you back, because I think that for us the conversation is an ongoing one, too. It's not something that gets solved right away. and it's not a one-shot newscast. But we're really happy you stopped by today and hope you come back soon.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you.
That was WOOC correspondent Steve Pierce talking with members of the One Troy Anti-Poverty Program.
And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I want to thank Jonah Moberg for being our engineer, putting up with us, and I'm Mark Dunley.
And I'm Dan Pfeiffer. Remember to tune in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page.
As a reminder, WOOC 105.3 is produced by local volunteers. If you are interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.